Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Our guest for this evening is Sanho Tree. He's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He travels extensively throughout Latin America on their behalf, on our behalf, and speaks and writes quite often on the subject of drug policy. Sanho, welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage.
Thanks, Dean. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, sir. It seems to me that we've imported to our shores something new and more powerful over the last couple of years. We've brought the drug war home to roost. There are journalists being shot out of the saddle. There's corruption in our border guards, the army, police, and others, by enormous payoffs. Large numbers of innocents and criminals are being wiped out by drug gangs. I know things are worse in Colombia and Mexico, but are we not now headed down here in the U.S. down that same road of widespread corruption and destruction that thrives so well in the drug-producing and trafficking countries?
Yeah, I mean, the drug economy is an equal opportunity corrupter, right? I mean, this is a serious problem that's been dogging us since the drug war has been around. Most recently, people have heard about the Zetas and the Mexican elite counter-narcotics unit that decided to go to work for themselves and become traffickers and a very violent gang, highly armed, highly trained, much of it with our tax dollars. You know, I live by the law of unintended consequences. You can't last a day in Washington without realizing that that's the one law that all parties must obey. And when we send these troops to go train foreign units on how to catch drug smugglers and how to do law enforcement, you also teach them inadvertently how to avoid law enforcement. And it comes back to haunt us time after time again. The most recent example of this, I'm on a listserv of private military contractors, some might call them mercenaries, and I lurk on that list, and I saw a job announcement from a person running a private outfit based in Ecuador, but he was running from Baghdad. And this is an American guy advertising the fact that he has Colombian soldiers for sale, or for rent, rather. Former soldiers, elite special forces, Colombians, who were trained by our special forces and our counter-narcotics people to do work in as private contractors in Iraq. Right, so they can get paid a fraction of what U.S. private contractors are paid, but they take the same risks. And after we train them to fight our drug war and fight, you know, the civil war in Colombia, these people have no allegiance necessarily. They're free to do what they want after their term expires, and so now they're renting themselves out to the highest bidder.
Sanho, I found some very disturbing news. To me, it's just incredible that the fact that many members of, is it the paramilitary, that if they will promise to do better, that they will actually get lighter sentence, or preso, I guess it's called, for the crimes they've committed.
Yes, there's a peace process, a negotiation right now between the government and the paramilitaries in Colombia to basically demobilize many of these units. And they're letting them off with a slap on the wrist, basically. And that's something that needs to be monitored very carefully. Certainly, the Colombian government doesn't have the capacity to prosecute and incarcerate all the paramilitaries. And many of them are very low-level people who either recruited forcibly or did so out of economic needs. But there are a lot of very, very vicious thugs and killers in this organization. And the paramilitaries are responsible for the vast majority of atrocities committed in Colombia's vicious wars. And when I talk about atrocities, I'm talking about killing 24 people with sledgehammers and rocks, smashing their skulls in. When they have plenty of bullets, they could kill these people just as easily with guns. But they choose to use tactics of terror. And so they'll do things like they'll cut people open with chainsaws, rip out their entrails, throw them into the river. And when the bodies flow downstream and the blood goes downstream, it sends a message to everyone down there saying, we're the new power in town. These people are on the Foreign Terrorist Organization of our State Department. They're on that list for a reason.
Yes, sir. And I've always had a little bit of trouble with the different nomenclatures, the rebels versus the paramilitary. But does the paramilitary not work closer with the government military?
Yeah. In fact, the paramilitaries, they have multiple origins, but they're basically the right-wing death squads operating in Colombia. Some of them come out of the background of working with the various cocaine cartels. Some of them work for big landowners who are interested in driving peasants and indigenous people off the land so they can acquire more land. And some of them serve as protection against extortion by guerrillas, the left-wing guerrillas that tax or kidnap the rich. And so they have multiple origins, and some of them actually come out of the military. And there's a long history of links between the Colombian paramilitary organizations and the Colombian military, which the United States government backs.
Okay, now, I know that each year the amount of opium grown in, let's say, Afghanistan just grows ever larger. But in Colombia, they say they've cut down more of these coca plants than ever before. Is this having an impact?
Oh, not at all. In fact, the price of cocaine on the streets of the United States has actually dropped for the pure gram since Plan Colombia began. The State Department says, oh, look how many acres we fumigated with our spray planes, therefore we must be winning. It's a meaningless metric. It's kind of like the body count was in during the Vietnam War. Because what they're not measuring is how many peasant farmers, how many campesinos are replanting right after they've been sprayed. They're replanting more productive varieties of coca, these things that are much bushier and have many more leaves and yield much more cocaine per acre, and the new varieties of shade-grown coca and all these other things. And so actually we're increasing efficiency in this marketplace. But the State Department only cares about one number, you know, how many acres have they sprayed, and they say, therefore we're winning.
Well, I know in Colombia they find laboratories, they burn them in the jungle, and you know, occasionally it'll make the media here in the U.S. But it's gone on for how many years, and how can they possibly call this success?
It's been, well, Plan Colombia began 5 years ago. It was supposed to be a 5-year plan, and so we're at the end of that now. And so the Bush administration is asking for more than $700 million to do on a year-by-year basis more of the same. Basically the exact same patterns, and it's been about as effective as shoveling water. When they say they've blown up and burned these labs in Colombia, what they really mean, the labs are so-called, there's nothing like a laboratory that you and I would think of. It's a shack, a wooden shack with a wooden floor and some plastic sheeting over the top of it to keep the rain out. And basically they spread out the coca leaves there, and they mix it with some basic chemicals like cement and sulfuric acid and gasoline to create the crude coca paste, which is what the traffickers use to refine into pure cocaine. And those kinds of laboratories that the traffickers use are very sophisticated, they're well hidden, and they actually euphemistically call them kitchens. And so when the State Department says they've blown up labs, what they're talking about is these little shacks, basically. It's a little wooden structure that costs less than $100 to build.
Well, and again, there are the economics involved. Describe to us the price of a pound of coca leaf, the paste, and then the product once it reaches U.S. shores. What are the economics to that?
Well, the coca farmers, the campesinos, these are people who live usually in very remote areas in the countryside with this little state presence, no infrastructure. And so growing coca makes good economic sense to them because they can convert it to coca paste and transport it very easily. A kilo or two of paste is easy to carry. Instead, we're asking them to grow hundreds of kilos of food crops, which they need to transport on vehicles they don't have, over roads that don't exist, to sell in markets, both domestic and export, they don't have access to. So who farms to go out of business? And these are people living in very poor conditions, and these are the people upon whom the guerrillas and the paramilitaries and the drug traffickers depend on. They prey on them, basically, because they're exploitable labor market. And so these farmers earn very little money, comparatively. Less than 1% of the final street price of cocaine in the United States goes to these farmers. Most of the money goes to the middlemen and to the traffickers. So we're attacking then the most inefficient part of the chain of production. When I debate the State Department officials, they say we're going after these coca growers because they are vulnerable. They use that word, vulnerable. they're not going after the so-called terrorists because those groups are very shadowy. They're hard to capture. They move around a lot, and they fight back. And so these peasant farmers, on the other hand, are rooted, literally rooted to the ground because their crops can't move very quickly. And that's why we attack them. Not because it does any good, but because they're static, essentially.
Yes, sir. And even on the flip side, in the U.S., it's kind of those who make the most money here are the middlemen.
Yeah.
And those they go after are not the farmers, but the retail sellers.
Right. If you look at this as basically two inverted pyramids that overlap at the points. The base of one pyramid is the peasant farmers on the production side, and the other base of on the upside down pyramid are the street level dealers and users. Whereas the two points of the pyramid that intersect in the middle, that's where the most money is. Those where the big traffickers are, and that's what we're not attacking. I'm not saying that would produce any different result. Basically, when we keep escalating law enforcement, we just create this Darwinian efficiency in the drug market.
Now, I know that in Colombia in particular over the last few months that U.S. soldiers and other, quote, civilian workers have been caught smuggling drugs, selling guns to the paramilitary, and otherwise working counter to our supposed interests for big money. How do you suppose we can ever manage this situation?
Well, I don't think that's a problem we can solve, quite frankly. It's been around as long as, you know, alcohol prohibition. People were always on the take. There's simply too much money involved in prohibition, especially when you have poorly paid soldiers who see an easy opportunity, or they think an easy opportunity, to make a tremendous amount of money. And so a couple of weeks ago, two U.S. soldiers were caught selling U.S.-supplied ammunition, about 30 or 40,000 rounds of ammunition, to these right-wing paramilitary death squads in Colombia. And a couple of months before that, five U.S. service personnel were arrested for smuggling cocaine or trying to smuggle cocaine back to the United States on a military flight. In 5 years before that, the head of our counter-narcotics unit down there, Colonel James Height, who was the head of the military group in the U.S. Embassy in Colombia, was convicted of money laundering, helping his wife, who was using the diplomatic pouch to smuggle heroin back to the United States. So we went straight into the embassy, to the very top of our drug war down there.
It's astounding. I mean, just the glaring truth, if you will. I had a talk with a state politician last night about the fact that I used my mantra, the day we regulate distribution to adults is the day we evaporate Osama's heroin's worth, is the day we begin to destroy the drug cartels, we eliminate the reasons for which the violent street gangs exist, and so forth. And I found that the person I was speaking to had never looked at it in that perspective and was very interested in coming on the show. Now, it's been my contention that all of these politicians are committing sins of commission, knowing full well what they're up to. But what's your thought? Are they actually that ignorant?
Oh, many of them are, but I think there's a confluence of ignorance and cowardice. Ignorance in the sense that when you talk about things like the international drug war, like Colombia, occupies a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of their mental space. And it's not necessarily their fault. They're asked to vote on just hundreds and hundreds of issues every month. When you walk the halls of Congress and the congressional office buildings, you hear the bells going off all the time. And every time you hear a bell, it means there's a vote going on some obscure amendment to some, you know, bill that, you know, they have no idea what they're voting on half the time. They're waiting for the staffers to tell them, you know, do we vote, you know, up or down on this particular amendment? And so they're constantly juggling a million different things. On the other hand, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out this hasn't been working. 5 years of Plan Colombia, the results are worse than ever. And there are a lot of members of Congress that are simply afraid to look soft on drugs and now soft on so-called narco-terrorists. And privately, they and their staff have been very frank to me, and they'll tell you what they're really concerned about. And it's those 15-second campaign ads, those negative ads that run during election season. You remember what they did with the Swift votes, for instance. You can take something and distort the daylights out of it and smear your opponent and watch the ratings go down day after day after day. So suppose I'm challenging you, Congressman Becker, who voted the right way, said this drug war is foolish. We're not going to support Plan Colombia. So all I have to do is raise a little bit of money to run those negative ads on TV and radio and smear you day after day. It'll go something like this. Friends, Congressman Becker doesn't care if your kids are dirty the drugs. He knows where the drugs are coming from. They're coming from Colombia. The Colombian government asked us. They begged us to help them fight this war on drugs. Congressman Becker refused to appropriate this money. Come on, folks. We all know what the game is. Send me to Washington. I'll approve this aid. We'll send the troops down there, clean up this mess, and I will protect your kids. Now, you being Congressman Becker, if you're lucky, you'll get maybe 15 seconds on a 6 o'clock news that night to explain to all of your constituents, many of whom saw this ad run over and over and over and over again, why you voted against a very complex and controversial aid package. And you have to hope that all of those people who saw the negative ad tune in for the 15 seconds you happen to be on the 6 o'clock news that night. So all things being equal, members of Congress tend not to vote against controversial bills.
So they can put some electricity in that third rail. I hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. And the discourse in our politics is being dumbed down day after day after day. It's appalling how simplistic the discourse is in Washington and around the nation. This administration has mastered that and perfected it to ways that were unimaginable, 5 years ago. That this is a war about good versus evil. This is, give him an up or down vote for John Bolton. Life rarely presents simple dichotomies, false dichotomies. The choices are complex, and there's a whole spectrum of possibilities to choose from, not just yay or nay, up or down.
Well, you brought to mind something that's just the last few years, that dumbing down has really increased. It's become, I think, even more evident of the mechanism at work. And I think if we could all open our eyes a little bit more and start trusting our own instincts, we can see it more easily.
I think it's a very conscious strategy on the part of Karl Rove and this administration that they look for hot-button issues they know will resonate with their core voters, for instance. And Rove even has a term for this. He calls them anger points. Gay marriage or school prayer or what have you. These are the things that he knows will anger his base and get them to the polls. It won't enlighten them. He's looking for anger, basically. And so this kind of polarization of evildoers versus patriots, that sort of thing, is really hurting America. John Stewart got a lot of praise when he went on Crossfire and made fun of Crossfire and says, "You guys are hurting America. Your scream fest is really not serving the public interest." The same could be said about this administration's tactics. They're dividing this country. They're polarizing this country for partisan political gain. It's not about evolving the best possible solutions to these problems. It's about how do you beat up on your opponents for electoral gain.
So very true. San Ho, I thank you for being with us. We've been speaking with San Ho Tree. He's a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies out of Washington, D.C. Any closing thought, San Ho?
Well, I think, people need to make their views heard to their legislators, to their representatives. It's not my place to tell you what to think, but whatever you think, let them know about it. Because if you don't, history is made by those who show up. And if we sit at home and watch our TVs and drink our beers and don't participate, we all lose in the end.
Drug czar of the Americas, John Walters, tells us that marijuana is illegal because it's harmful.
Some of the most dangerous drugs aren't on the street. They're under your sink. Household products kids sniff to get high. Protect your kids. Tell them never to sniff inhalants, because the first time can kill.
A message from the Partnership for a Drug-Free Texas and America.
The Partnership for a Drug-Free America is an enormous, fraudulent enterprise. But in this one instance, they did get it right. It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Permanent damage to the liver, eyes, bone marrow, heart and blood vessels, convulsions, impaired mental function, neurological damage, kidney damage, irregular heartbeats, unbearable stress, sudden sniffing death. Time's up. The answer, Lucy. Gasoline. There's a vending machine in your neighborhood. What will it take to motivate? Please visit drugtruth.net. Journey for Justice, the mass protest against mass incarceration. Washington, D.C., August 13th. U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee.
I'm glad that this march will be taking place. I'll be looking forward to getting the list of names of the organizations to be able to reach out to them. We can again move forward with legislation that will bring this to the floor of the House for a vigorous debate.
Please visit journeyforjustice.org.
Again, I want to thank Sanho Tree. He brings a pretty strong and unique perspective, I think, to the discussion of drugs.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
A senior Western official, speaking on condition of anonymity to the L.A. Times, said this week that some Afghan drug lords are now part of the government, quote, at the highest level, end quote. General Mohammad Daoud, Afghanistan's drug czar, who denies involvement in the drug trade, acknowledges senior government officials are involved. However, Western officials active in the effort admit privately that warlord Daoud was formerly a drug lord himself before being appointed to head the nation's drug war. Also this week, Afghan anti-drug forces raided a remote village that was identified as a, quote, a drug bazaar and seized 500 pounds of heroin. The anti-drug commandos claimed that hundreds of smugglers had escaped across the border into Pakistan. Remarkably, no arrests were made. Thanks to a wet winter, farmers in northern Afghanistan say they're enjoying a bumper poppy crop. While no official estimates are yet available, some reports suggest that this year's crop will surpass last year's record harvest. This is Gwen Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
And here's our own Phil Jackson.
Some people say a man is made out of...
And now another black perspective on the drug war. One aspect of the war on drugs that I've always found to be most upsetting is the fact that drugs are thought of as a black problem. The drug problem as a black issue would suggest that blacks are somehow more susceptible to the lure of drugs or less morally upright. There was always the unsettling concern that there might be something wrong with me. There's as much drug use in the dorm rooms by white kids as in the doorways by black kids. And many more white hands importing it, taking and giving the bribes, laundering the proceeds, and certainly profiting from it. If anything, this is predominantly a white problem and not a black one. But like every other aspect of this cockeyed drug war, it makes no sense at all. From the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
Good to have Phil Jackson back with us. Phil, keep up the good work, my friend. And speaking of that march on D.C.
My name is Bertie Franklin, and I am founder and director of Family and Friends of Incarcerated People in Montgomery, Alabama.
You've got a big event planned for this August. We have a big event planned. Tell us about that, please.
Yes, we do. We have the first annual historic, I might add, Family Members and Friends of Incarcerated People march to Washington. It's August 13th from 9 to 12 at Lafayette Park. That's right near the White House. We've called on thousands of family members, activists, organizations, and we hope to be there. We hope that all of you will come out and support this very, very important cause.
About the reason for this march?
Well, one of the reasons is, you know, as I was sitting in Little Alabama, and by the way, I live in Montgomery, Alabama, home of the civil rights movement. So you got a lot of little radical women down here that if we don't like stuff, we get up and we get moving. So many organizations and so many people who represent the interests of inmates. But in my opinion, some things are getting done, but very little. The prison walls are continuing to grow. They're continuing to lock up people for minimal things. They're continuing to keep people 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, how long is long enough? And as I started to look at that, I wanted to emphasize, to focus on, well, now, who would have more power to do anything about these current situations? Would it be the organizations, or if we've got 2 million men and women incarcerated, we have an estimated 4.5 million family members of those incarcerated people. These people are not locked up. They are taxpayers, they are voters, they are mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters. Many of them have founded their own organizations. Many of them are very small grassroots organizations who function on little or no money, and they do fantastic work on a local level. So my concept was, let's bring all of these people together under one banner in the same place at the same time, so we can at least let society know, look, these inmates are not by themselves. You know, Dean, they've taken a stance. They've done the tough on crime stance, and, you know, where you slam the doors and we're going to lock up criminals. And that was a political gimmick some years ago. And it, sadly, it has continued to this day. Well, my position, and it still is, the people that are really going to be the ones that make a difference are going to be the inmates themselves and their loved ones and the people, activists, and organizations that work from their heart, not from pimping inmates to secure funding to keep their big money jobs. And I hate to say it that way, but that's just a fact.
Well, Roberto, if folks wanted to learn more about the event, where might they go on the web?
They can go to journeyforjustice.org, no spaces, no commas. Journeyforjustice.org, they can go there, they can get their hotel accommodations, they can find information about their flights, they can find out information about some of the speakers that will be coming there. And that's another thing, Dean, we're using real people. I don't have any gimmicks. This is not a rap concert. You can't come see Snoop Doggy Dogg. You can't come see Nelly, because when all of that gimmickry is gone and it's all over and done, nobody's doing anything about the people locked up. These are going to be real people with real stories, real issues, real activists, and real organizations that do the work.
Okay, I want to remind folks that we offer $750 cash money to anybody from the criminal justice system, basically from a police captain on up, who's willing to come on this show and explain to us the need for drug war.
Afghanistan's ruler, Hamid Karzai, recently visited the U.S. seeking more aid. UN officials have been touting the success of anti-drug efforts in that war-torn country. Tons of opium have been seized this year. A huge raid on a reputedly notorious arms bazaar was just in the news. Yet the truth lies behind the headlines. The arms and drug bazaar which was raided? No one was actually arrested. Some opium and heroin was reportedly seized. No reports of weapons. The raid was carried out by a new secret Afghan anti-drug squad, like the ones we've trained in Colombia and other countries in which we wage our drug war. Sadly, this one seems to be just as effective, presuming, that is, the raid was intended to succeed. It could have been merely staged for media consumption. Meanwhile, UN hopes about this year's Afghan heroin output are being dashed. The Institute for War and Peace Reporting reports that Afghan farmers are harvesting a bumper crop of opium. Taking advantage of regional instability, traffickers will move more heroin out of there this year than ever before. Reporting for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Be sure to join us next week when our guest will be U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. And as always, I remind you, my friends, please be careful. You don't know what's in that bag.
For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT in Houston. Tap dancing on the edge of cannabis.